The Magic Book Club with Bensons for Beds.
Hello, welcome along to the Magic Book Club podcast. Tom Price here with the podcast where we find out exactly what makes our favourite authors put pen to paper, or, you know, I guess fingertips to keyboard. On this episode, we're joined by absolute writing icon Marianne Keyes. Absolutely fantastic. We love Marianne Keyes. And also the mind behind fantastic new debut Space Hopper, a lady called Helen Fisher. So sit back, make yourself a cup of tea or something stronger if you want. That's very much your decision. Or spark up that treadmill in the garage if you're feeling really brave. And we will find out just what makes these authors tick as you go about your day. Okay, first up today then, we are joined by the very, very magnificent human being behind 18 books that we know and love, from anybody out there to this charming man. Marianne is a British staple to our bookshelves. Please welcome the wonderful Marianne Keyes. Hello, Marianne Keyes, how are you?
I'm fine, Tom. It's lovely to talk to you. You have the most calming, beautiful voice.
I will take that and run with it. Thank you,
Marianne. Oh,
that's very kind of you. But I'm neither a calm nor a beautiful person. That's the only problem.
Well, you sound like one, and frankly, that's good enough for me at the moment.
That's my new Twitter biog, sorted. There we are, done. Marianne, listen, I finished Grown Ups last night, and I absolutely...
Thank you.
I delayed watching a box set with my wife. She had to sit there sulking at the end of the sofa. I was like, no, I've got
really?
The buckets. I was in the lighthouse, Matt. It was the lighthouse bit. I hope that's not a spoiler. It was wonderful.
Thank
it was
you.
Wonderful. So this we're celebrating the paperback launch of the book. How does it feel when the paperback comes out? Because it must be about a billion years ago that you actually wrote this book now.
I mean, it came out in hardback a year ago and I finished it about 6 months before that. No, do you know what? It feels absolutely lovely to get to talk about it again and to revisit it. And it was a book that I really loved writing, and I was very, very fond of the characters in it. So, no, I'm glad to be back there.
The characters are fantastic. I mean, it's just, I love all of them, maybe apart from Liam. But,
yes,
but,
yeah.
I'm probably not the first to point that out. But that is something which it's so hard to do. Like, thinking of stuff to happen in a book is one thing, but to be able to create people and so efficiently, like these guys say three words at the beginning and I know who they are and I like them and I want to know more about them. How do you have that knack? How do you develop that knack? How do you keep that knack?
I mean, thank you so much. The thing is, like, a lot of people think, you know, writing novels is some sort of mystical process, and that the magic novel just arrives into the tips of your fingers and you type it. And it's not that at all. Like, people hate me when I tell them it's hard work. But that's kind of a lovely thing to hear, because it means that anybody can write a novel and create characters that are believable or likable or dislikable or whatever. So I spend a lot of time on my characters. And I think it helps if you're like me, if you are very interested in people. Also, it really, really helps if you were the weirdo at school who was always an outsider, you know. So when you have that kind of distance on the rest of the world, you have no choice but to kind of observe people and see what makes them tick, because that's about the most fun you're going to have in a particular day. So it's down to kind of, I suppose, your basic personality type. And, you know, time and time again, like, I hit walls with characters that I'm creating and thinking, oh my God, no, they just sound like they are so wooden and ridiculous and nobody would speak like that in real life. And so then I ask myself, well, yeah, but what would they say? You know, what would they say? Find it and make them say it. So just keep at it until you believe them. It also helps if you like them a little bit, apart from one or two. You have to have a couple of baddies. But even they have to be sort of fairly well-rounded.
Yes, yeah. I think I love the thing about the weirdo. The weirdos will inherit the earth. Let's just...
Yes, we will. Well, I'm including you in that, Tom.
Totally.
I may be making a terrible mistake.
No, you're definitely not. I'm slightly concerned because my kids seem to be fitting in at school. And I'm like, boys, you need to be weirdos. The weirdos, they're the best ones. They're the
yes,
winners.
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah, we're playing the long game, Tom. We really are. Yes, you might have your very happy childhood and your wonderful teenage years and often your gap years around the world with your loving friends. Ha ha! We're biding our time here alone in our bedrooms.
It's the pain that will make us win.
But,
and there's a lot of painful things that happen in this book. There's some real tragedies that happen way before the book starts. Obviously, the loss of Jesse's husband. That is a sort of shadow that sits across the whole book. How do you begin to write about that, the impact that has on someone? It's such a huge thing, and it's so hard to do it without being trite and cliche, and you avoid those things magnificently. But how do you approach it?
I mean, thanks. I suppose I just feel that everybody goes through stuff. There isn't a single one of us that hasn't suffered some sort of loss or some sort of, you know, incredible shock. And I think most people manage to exist alongside it. I think, you know, we are always altered by whatever that big thing is. But most of us manage to keep going. I think that's how human beings are built. We're built to accommodate tragedy in some way. Jesse's first husband died. But I mean, Jesse in particular, I loved her because she's so different to me. Like she's a survivor, you know, she's a toughie, you know, and she doesn't believe in self-pity. I'm not saying that, you know, my God, like if somebody has been bereaved, feel whatever you feel, my God, and my heart goes out to you. But she is just one of those. It's almost like she's slightly unimaginative. And that's in a way her saving grace. And I don't think anybody can really write a novel where it's good things all the time. You know, I woke up and something amazing happened and then another amazing thing happened. I drove in my gorgeous car to my fabulous job where everybody loves me. I'm never stressed. I get paid so much, you know, but like page four, like it's like, I hate you. I absolutely hate you. And I really hope something terrible happens to you. And I don't want to read you about you anymore until that terrible thing happens.
Where's the bad stuff?
Give me the bad stuff.
That's why the Bible was so good.
That you're absolutely right. They didn't stint on the old disasters, you know. And look, it's what the most read book in the world. There you are,
huge numbers,
figures
great numbers
for themselves. Yeah. Yes, yeah. No, everybody suffers in some way or another, and I think reading about it is both comforting, and it's also just a kind of a reminder that this is how life is.
Yeah, and it makes you feel better about your own life. It makes you feel comforted by what's going on with other people. And I think one of the stories we should really hone in on it is Cara. And you take on the story of Cara's eating disorder. And I'm lucky enough to, I don't know anyone in my life who's had that. It's not something I've got any familiarity with at all. But that I've gleaned a whole new understanding from Cara's story. It feels like a really important one.
Yeah, she suffers from bulimia, and in a way, bulimia, I mean, all addictions are horrible things to live with, and eating disorders in particular, because, you know, a person with an eating disorder has to engage with the object of their agony, you know, every single day. Yeah. But with people at the extremes of eating disorders, you know, people who have anorexia to people who have compulsive overeating tendencies, it's hard. Their illness is visible on their body. Whereas with bulimia, you can survive and you can hide in plain sight for years and years, because most bulimics, through huge hidden efforts, manage to stay at a fairly regular weight. And it just means that their awful secret hell goes on for much, much longer. And, you know, any addict, and I speak for one myself, like I'm a recovering alcoholic, the secrecy and the shame is the killer. You know, it is so incredibly difficult to have this whole, it's very hard work being an addict, you know, planning when you're next going to manage, like in Cara's case, a binge and a purge, trying to keep the people she loves from finding out about it. And it interferes with interpersonal relationships, because for Cara, she and Ed, her husband, like they are a real love match. But when she's in the throes of her addiction, her addiction matters more to her than he does. And so I mercifully have been lucky enough to have been spared that. But I researched it thoroughly because I wanted to do it justice, and I wanted to treat it tenderly because, you know, and accurately, because somebody who goes through this, it's a very difficult and painful way to live. The only thing is, I know two people, and they have recovered from bulimia. So I felt kind of, I felt okay to write about it because I felt I could be hopeful when I was writing about it.
Yeah, it is. It's, I mean, the information that you impart to us about it, things like, it's said again and again, it could kill you. This thing could kill you. You know, I have this slightly stereotyped image in my head of anorexia, thin. That is what leads to, you know, disaster. But with bulimia, it's not quite that. It's different. And this idea that she could have died doesn't mean just because she wasn't wasting away and tiny doesn't mean she wasn't very, very, very dangerously ill. And that was really alarming to me. That really shook me.
Yeah, because of the, you know, the continued stress that is put on the body from the purging. Yeah. Like, she could have had a heart attack. Like, it happens.
Yeah. So Cara's story is obviously a very important one. And also, it's at the heart of the story is three brothers. And as one of three brothers, I love the way that... the way the three brothers... They don't really talk to each other at any, but they have the most cursory, sort of blunt conversations with each other. And I was like, yeah, I see that. I see that. And I definitely reflect that.
Yeah. I have two brothers-in-law. And I think the way men communicate is very different to the way women communicate. I mean, from the way I see it, men communicate by insulting each other. You know, that they make mock that, like, you know, their football team lost, or, you know, something went wrong with their car. But nevertheless, I think of when it comes down to it, like, that men are actually there for each other. They just don't excavate emotions the way women do. That's my experience anyway.
Yes, that, me too. I would definitely go with that. If I opened up with emotions to my brother, you like, the look I'd get.
Tom, are you all right? Yeah. Lie down. Yeah.
I am the flighty actor at the three of us. The other two are like these repressed, ultra British
Right.
I'm feeling that would result in them just walking out of the room. They'd rather just take the piss out of my haircut and move on.
Yes.
So I mean, that is the male relationships in the story obviously important, but the thing that sort of that I loved about this and found fascinating and is such a resonant topic is the judgment on women. Like, men can get away with so much stuff, and we'll get onto that, but the way that women are judged for their in Jessie's case, maybe their career, when she picks up with Johnny, it's all about her. Moving on to Johnny. Johnny doesn't seem to get any blame particularly. It's all about her choices. Cara feels judged at work. There seems to be this almost this Mission Impossible. You know, like Tom Cruise when he's in Mission Impossible and he's going through all the laser beams. There's something that image just kept popping up into my head. It's just the network of judgment that goes on for women. It was terrifying to read that.
Yeah, I mean, I think public ownership is taken of women's appearance. You know, it happens so all the time, whatever the word is, ubiquitously, that we don't even notice it. You know, like, women will get the scan if their skirt is too tight, you know, if their lipstick is too bright, you know, it's very often about weight, you know, or dressing too young for their age. But, like, you're absolutely right, like, there are kind of, it's death by a thousand cuts. Yeah. And most women are so used to it that we barely register it on an individual basis, but, you know, we kind of scurry through the streets in a fairly hunted way, I feel. The only thing is, I do think it's getting better. I think younger women, like, especially those under 30, are approaching it differently and saying, like, don't you dare judge me. You know, don't you dare have an opinion on whether I've lost weight or put on weight. It's none of your business. And I love that. Yeah. I have a niece who's 20 and, you know, I get so much courage from her. You know, and the way, like, if a woman becomes pregnant, everybody is, oh, she's very big for 6 months, you know. She'd really want to watch whatever she's eating. She'd want to knock it off. You know, everyone has an opinion. And, you know, and even that thing of, you know, people saying to you, you've lost weight, that's meant to be a compliment. Like, if anybody ever says that to me, and believe me, it's rare, my heart sort of, I don't know, bleeds, because I feel like, oh, I see, you've been weighing me with your eyes all this time. And now, because I had a bout of gastroenteritis, you know, I have temporarily lost 1.5 pounds. And suddenly you're behaving as if I should be carried, you know, on people's shoulders through cheering crowds.
Yeah.
Like, it's so wrong.
It's gross, isn't it? The moment when someone says to Cara, well, you haven't lost much weight. I mean, that was just...
Oh, yes.
Mom.
Yes.
Oh, that was awful.
Yeah, you're a failed bulimic.
Yes, I had that was a definite stop moment. Every now and again in this book, you have these stop moments where you look up. But you're right, there is hope, and there is hope in the younger generation. And also, I guess, not to be too cheesy about it, but the hope and the love in this book is everywhere. The all the interrelationships, all the young children.
Thank
everywhere.
You.
All this cross network of family is beautiful, because I'm one of those people. My wife isn't. She's a complete cantankerous old hermit, and she's an only child. She's a tiny family, and we got married years ago, and suddenly she started having to come on all these massive family holidays with all my brothers and their kids and stuff like that. I love all this stuff. Was it a joy to write about all those big family events?
Tom, it was a total, total joy. Like, I have, I'm from a family of five, which it feels kind of small by Irish standards. But like, we're all big personalities. And we go on holiday together. You know, I love my nieces, my nephews, my in-laws. Like, and we travel kind of en masse, like as a posse. And I love the mix of ages. Like, I have the youngest nephew is a year. My oldest niece is 20. And I just adore them. And I adore my brothers and sisters-in-law. And I love the idea of a big, huge, messy family where you're allowed to not like everybody. But there's always somebody there to talk with. And yeah, I loved writing all these scenes, and I loved writing all the interactions. And as you know, you read to the end, you read to the lighthouse scene. Something happens that probably wasn't meant to have happened, but I'm so delighted it did, because I'm such an old romantic, really.
Yes, you've got to have that. We have to have that icing on the cake.
No,
not even ice. That's like the bow on the icing on the cake at the end. We've got to have that.
Thank you.
I tell you what, the sign that I love this book, Marion, is the fact that as soon as I finished it, I was like, I said to my wife, you need to read this now, because we need to talk about it. It's like, I need to talk about these characters, that connection with those characters. It's rare to get that, you know, these days. It's so enjoyable.
Thank you.
I loved it. So talk to me about, we've talked about the... Yeah, loving all the extended family and all that stuff. That must have made the last however many years lockdown's been, 45 years, particularly hard and tricky. How have you navigated lockdown? How have you got through it?
Oh, I mean, it has been really hard. We were allowed to go away in the summer. We were, we had, I don't know, about 3 weeks where suddenly things were okay. So we went to Kerry, to a hotel in Kerry for a week. 15 of us went. And honestly, the memories of that have kept me going, you know.
Yes.
But like, I haven't, like, my poor mother hasn't left the house since mid-December. Like, I missed them terribly. You know, and I live with my husband, so like, you know, we're allowed to hug each other. But I feel for people who are being deprived of affection. You know, and sometimes, but we're not even allowed to do this anymore in Ireland. Sometimes the nieces and nephews would come over and stand in the garden, and we'd shout at each other that we loved each other. But we literally can't even visit each other in gardens at the moment. And because the weather has been so bad, you know, going for walks in public places has been difficult. But, you know, spring is coming.
Yes, it is.
We're into February already.
Yes.
And, you know, it's really important to stay hopeful, because this particular one, I think, has been extra grim. For probably just attrition. We're just worn down by it. So we've got to stay hopeful. But yeah, it's been hard. You know, I hate my house. You know, I hate my bedroom. I hate, you know, all the familiar things. I'm so lucky that I have somewhere to live, but I hate it.
Yeah. And your partner becomes like a colleague as well. Beth and I just walked past each other, just
you
a polite
again.
Nod. Hello there.
Yeah.
Hello.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Do you think about how you might, I know it's risky to insert this world into a novel. The last thing people are going to want to do is read about lockdown after it's happened. But do you ever sort of think, how would I put this into fiction? How would I make this? Or is it a bit too real at the moment?
Yeah. No way.
Keep and you off know, it.
And when yeah, and when we come out of this, I never want it referred to ever again. Mm-hmm. It's just going to be you know, that terrible unpleasantness around there at the start of the decade. But we just don't refer to it.
Yes.
It's going to be like some, you know, some awful secret, that beastly business up at the hall. We're not going to talk about it ever again once it's over.
Have you been writing functionally? What I'm inching towards, Marion, is the big boring question at the end, which is what is next? What have you been working on? What's the plan, please? That's what.
Okay. Well, funnily enough, I had started a novel before the current unpleasantness started, and between the jigs and the reels, it's actually set in 2018 for reasons that would become clear. Now, I mean, at some stage, it is going to have to actually come into the present, and I don't know how I will deal with it then, but it will be briskly. You know, when we get to this bit. But most of the action has taken place 2 years ago. And that was just incredible good for... It's because I'm writing a sequel. And it's the first sequel I've ever written. And it needed to be set in 2018 because it did.
Well, what's it the sequel to? Are you allowed to tell us which one it's a sequel to?
Yeah, it's a sequel to Rachel's Holiday, which... It was a book about a young woman who went to rehab for drug addiction, honestly thinking that there was nothing wrong with her. And by the end of her time, she realised how wrong she had been. And it was a book that meant an awful lot to a lot of people, especially those who had maybe had parents who were addicts or alcoholics, or people themselves who were going through it. They suddenly got that kind of, oh my God, moment. And it's a lot of people feel affection for it. So I'm trying my best to not let them down as I write this new bit.
It's an interesting theme, though, isn't it? The idea that Rachel thought there's nothing wrong with her. Cara, similarly, you know, she says that a lot. There's nothing wrong with me. There's nothing wrong with me. I don't need this.
Yeah. But denial is a huge part of active addiction. You know, denial is a real thing. People think it's it's just an excuse almost. When people are in the throes of an addiction, they have to protect it. And, you know, because they don't want to stop. So the best way to protect themselves is to tell themselves that this is temporary and it's not actually a problem. And that when circumstances improve, they'll be able to stop. But it is really not a problem right now.
And the idea that this addiction stays with you forever as well, that's so important. It is part of you, and you have to sort of take ownership of that.
That's right. Yeah. And it's not that awful. Mm. You know, speaking as one who wakes up every day and says, well, I better take care of myself today. It's really fine. You know, it like people with diabetes take their insulin. Like it's perfectly manageable.
Mm. When did you stop drinking?
27 years ago.
And it's still that my mum went through rehab 25 years ago, and she still says it feels as fresh today, like it's still an everyday thing.
Oh, it is. I mean, and that doesn't mean like it's a bad thing. It's just important to remember that, like, you know, the most important fact that I know about myself is that I'm an alcoholic, and that if I don't drink, I will have a wonderful life, and that I need to protect that sobriety, and then just everything is normal. Other than the fact that I don't drink, everything is normal.
Yeah. So, Marion, listen, I'm going to let you go back to lockdown. Sorry, it is back to lockdown. and good luck with the launch of the paperback of Grown Ups. It's a fantastic book, and it's a character creating, it's a storytelling masterclass. I absolutely loved it. Marion Keyes, thank you so much for coming on the Magic Book Club podcast.
You're an angel. Thank you so much for having me.
Isn't she marvellous? The fabulous Marianne Keyes there on the Magic Book Club podcast. Okay, so next up on today's episode of the Book Club podcast here on Magic, we've got the fabulous debut novelist. She's only gone and written a time travel novel, which is, I mean, that's already ticking a very big box for me because I love time travel novels.
Well, that was an accident, so sorry about that.
Thank you. It's really worked for me. The brilliant Helen Fisher and Space Hopper is out now. Helen, your debut novel, congratulations.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
How does it feel?
Feels amazing, but it's been such a long time getting to publication day that you become sort of, it all becomes quite surreal. You do feel like you're looking in from through the window and going, I think that's me that's happening to you. It's sort of you become a bit removed from it, but I feel great.
It's so lovely. It's one of the first things I do these days when I'm doing these interviews. I go and look at the acknowledgements before I start reading the book. And it says, when I was sick of rejections and put my manuscript in a drawer and cried myself to sleep until I came to terms with never getting published. That's in the acknowledgements. And I always think there's always a fascinating story in the acknowledgements of a book. Always, if you're ever browsing a book in a bookshop, have a look at the acknowledgements, because often there's an interesting story in there. Tell us a bit about that. This sounds like there was some elements of despair in this journey to publication for you.
Yeah, there was. And I always read the acknowledgements first. I never understand how people don't, but I always
yes.
do as well.
Yes.
And it's really they're really interesting, aren't they? So I wrote Space Hopper, and I had written a novel the year before, which I sent out, and then I kind of thought, oh no, this isn't going anywhere, and I've had this other idea. So I wrote Space Hopper and sent it to an editor. I didn't have any money at the time, but I scraped together to send it to an editor just to get some professional feedback, tweaked it a bit, and then sent it out to agents. And I had read how hard it is to get an agent, so I knew that it was, you know, really, really difficult to get one, like almost impossible to get one. But I had real faith in my story. So I sent it out, and I kept, this is going to sound ridiculous, and it's going to make me sound conceited, and I'm not, but I just kept thinking, oh, this will land on someone's desk, and there'll be like this dusty gold phone on the desk, and they'll wipe it off and pick it up and go, I think we've found one, you know, it's like that. I just had this feeling that somebody was going to like it. But then yeah. I got my first rejection, and honestly, I felt like part of me died. And but I kept hopeful. So between October and December 2018, I think I sent out about 17 to 17 agents, and I got rejected. Mm. And every time I got rejected, I felt like I was standing in a massive hole, and I was just having shovelful after shovelful of dirt being thrown on me, and I just got buried with it, and I could not take the rejection anymore. And I just thought, I got it wrong, it's not good enough. I cried myself to sleep for quite a while, and I just thought, and I didn't want to write anymore either. I just thought, if I can't do it with this, I thought, this is the best I've got in me at the moment, and if nobody wants it, then you know, it's not going to happen. But you'll have also read in the acknowledgements that when I had given it up, I had a message from a friend about 2 months later in February 2019. Now, she is the fiance of my ex-husband, and we haven't always got on, but we do get on really well. And she reads loads. And in the October, when I started sending the manuscript out, she asked if she could read it. And I said, oh, I'm not sure. She said, I won't tell anyone, and I'll burn it after reading and that kind of thing. She read it, and she really liked it. She said some nice things. But in the February 2019, when I'd given up, she sent me a message saying, I've just read a book that makes me feel a bit like Space Hopper did. It's got a mother and daughter at the centre. It's got this 70s vibe. It's completely different from yours, but there was just something about it. Mm. And the next day when I was in Waterstones, I picked this book up, flipped to the back, to the acknowledgements, just to see if the agent was mentioned, and she was. And I thought, right, I'll send it out one more time. And I sent it out to Judith Murray at Green and Heaton, and I'd looked her up, and she was like this super agent. I thought, well, she's got so many submissions coming in, this is like less than a needle in a haystack kind of thing. And but I had she got in touch, and that was it. She did love it.
Oh, that's so lovely. Wow. So it had gone into the drawer, and it was never coming back out again.
Yeah, I mean, people don't put their manuscripts into drawers anymore because it's not actually paper, but, you know,
I know, the metaphorical drawer. Yeah.
No, I keep saying I put it in the drawer because that's what it felt like, and I locked it, and I didn't swallow the key. I just put it in a really old pencil case I never use, you know, metaphorically, and and I felt very sad about it, very, very, very sad. But I was very lucky, and I think that there is some luck and some fate and timing and... yeah, you've got to get the right agent, and everybody says it, but it's so important.
Yeah. But that sounds like, you know, that's tactics, that's strategy. You've got to think about it like that, in those terms of looking at the book and looking who the agent is, and that's all to the good. But there is a bit of luck. There's also a whole heap of talent, which you've obviously got in spades, Helen, because it's a gorgeous book. Congratulations.
Oh,
it is
really. Thank you so much.
Really, I'm really enjoying it. Let's talk first of all, and I hope this is okay to say, you've already mentioned your ex-husband, and you know, that's your personal private life, and yet in this book there's a lot of stuff about parenting. Faye is her mum Jeannie was a single parent. This must have been an important part of you, an important part of your story to tell in this book.
Yeah, I think I realised that retrospectively. All those, you know, and I think sometimes you know, this must happen to, you know, you sometimes you consciously write about things that you know, and sometimes it's going to come out unconsciously. And when I looked back, I thought, I mean, I had an interview the other day and someone said that he was really quite wound up by Eddie because Eddie was this perfect bloke. And I thought, yeah, but I could write a perfect bloke. I wrote this lovely husband, you know, and you know, that was almost purposefully done. But the interesting thing was that lots of people have, I mean, I wrote it in the first person, and Faye is probably the closest in age to me to any of the other characters. So if I'm like anyone, annoying as she can be, I am more like Faye than anyone, and people have said that. But my son read the book, and my son is, he's 11 now, but he was 10 when he read it. And he said that I was like Jeannie. He thought I was much more like Jeannie than I was like Faye, which I found quite interesting. And I don't really know why he felt like that. Maybe because I am a single parent, or I don't know. But yeah, there is a lot of parenting in it. And I don't know if you like, you kind of fill the holes that you might have had in your own experiences, or but you're right, there is a lot of parenting, and I've never really thought about that. It's the first time I've been asked about parenting.
Well, it's a lovely scene that's leaping out for me as I read it. And maybe it's just because I'm a, you know, currently parenting in lockdown, and you know, reading this book and seeing just the importance of, you know, time with your kids. So to explain, Faye, it sounds crackers, but it works. She gets in a box and goes back in time. I mean, that's basically it, isn't it, Helen? And when she goes back in time, the first thing she thinks is she's missing her kids. She's missing that connection with her kids. And then she sees herself as a kid, and there's all sorts of childhood and parenting. And I'm reading this book, and I'm suddenly like, I need to go and spend time with my kids. You just have this, it connects with you. It connects with, well, the whole book is just brimming with love, isn't it?
It is brimming with love. That's what people have said, and I'm glad that comes across. It's interesting. I was talking about this earlier today, which is really weird. When Faye goes back in time and she's missing her kids, she says something along the lines of, you know, she's used to being perhaps away from them for a night or a weekend or something like that. But this isn't like being even in a different country to your children. This is, you know, you're in a different time, which removes you like that extra step. And my God, my ex-husband's getting a lot of air on here. But when we first split up and he took them on holiday with like his side of the family, you know, I just wanted somebody to shoot me with a tranquilizer gun, because I had never been in a different country to my children. I'd always been able to see them with my own two eyes, and or at the very least, you know, drive 10 minutes and there they were. But to know that I was hours away from them in a different country, in a different time zone, I found that traumatizing. And I think when I was writing that bit about her going back and missing her children, I probably drew on that a little bit. The thought of being she wasn't in a different country, she was in the same country, but, you know, so far removed. She might have
different
been on a different planet.
Different worlds. Exactly. Yeah. It is, but that's what's so sort of weirdly heartwarming about it, is that, you know, that there's people are missed like limbs. You know, she misses her mother like missing a limb. She's missing her kids like missing a limb. She even misses the people who become her foster parents. You know, and in that absence, noting that absence, we feel the love. It's a weird thing, isn't it? When you acknowledge someone's absence, you realise how much your life is defined by those people being with you, kind of thing.
Yeah, the measure of love is loss. So
exactly.
You know that old cliche, you don't know what you've got till you've lost it. Although I like to think that I want to live my life knowing what I've got and knowing how it would feel. I don't feel like I need to lose the things in my life that I love in order to be able to appreciate them. But I think that it is quite a common thing that you really don't. And perhaps during this whole lockdown, you know, everybody's assessing what it is that they really, really are missing, just from their daily lives, not in terms of death necessarily, although for some people that is going to be the case. Yeah. But, you know, in terms of daily life, we're starting to, it's very sharp focus, you know, the people that we miss, people we want to hug, that sort of thing.
I think we often lose ourselves in fiction, much like this, because, you know, this is a slightly weird thing to say, but I've often pondered in a very theoretical way, what would people who've had near-death experiences, who then have this post-experience, post-life of being living for the moment, living each day as it comes. They are so full of life because they nearly lost it. And I do think that sometimes we read novels like this to scratch that itch and to sort of, what would it be like if we had this sense of having lost everything or reconnecting with stuff that we had assumed we'd lost forever? And it's such a great fantasy to read this character, Faye, go on that journey. Did you enjoy going on that journey with her? Was it an escapist experience for you as the writer to do that?
God, it was a really, I haven't lost my parents, but I have, you know, I've experienced loss like most people have. Mm. And I wrote it because, so I started writing it with this idea that, you know, I had friends who'd lost their parents or their mum when they were little, and now they were getting to that age where they had children of the same age they were when they lost their mum. And then they were also getting to that age where they were older than their mum had ever got to be. And I kind of thought, wouldn't it be lovely? And they were having a bit of a crisis. And I thought, wouldn't it be nice for them to be able to talk to their mum now as an adult? So that was kind of why I wrote it. So when Faye goes back and has that opportunity, I did enjoy it, but I didn't really know what to do. I found myself up against a brick wall because I haven't lost a parent, so I couldn't imagine, well, what would be the first thing that you would want to do? And or what would you ask them? And I think there's quite a lot in the book about, you know, her kind of having this dilemma, you know, what do I try and find out from my mum while I've got this opportunity? And you know, that's a big question for her, and it's explored in quite some detail. And but I was slightly at a loss. You know, there were many a time where I sort of just, you know, I'd have to sit there with my eyes shut and think, what would I do? What would I really, really do? Yeah. And if people ask me who I would go back and see, who's died, I find that a very hard question to answer because, you know, who would you see and what would you ask them when you got there? I don't know.
But this is why we need good writers to take us on that journey, which is what you're doing. I'm fascinated by the idea of you know, trying to think of that. What happens if I walk into your study, Helen, you're writing away. What do I see? Are you like, is your face scrunched up? Are you looking out the window? Are you checking Twitter? What is happening? Are you enjoying this process, or is it just like a really painful labour?
Oh God, it's all those things. So I look really calm and I look like I know what I'm doing. That's how I actually come across. But I don't know if you ever watched The Durrells. Did you ever watch
The Durrells? I love The Durrells. So
you know Lawrence Durrell, who's obviously a famous author. And you know how he's kind of, I picture him sort of wandering around his room with a long silky dressing gown, hair looks like he's like been dragged through a bush, and he's smoking furiously. In my head, that is me. That is what I'm doing. And when I'm thinking about going to my computer, that's what I look like to myself. Right. But I don't appear, but nobody else would see that. So I'm like, I'm paddling furiously under the water. And I quite enjoy the process, but it's also a bit like, I just have to get it out. And I feel happier when it's out. So sometimes I'm writing it, I'm thinking, this is okay. This is going all right. I think this is all right. And then I step away from my computer and all of a sudden it's all complete shit. It's rubbish.
It just crumbles.
Yeah, I go back to the computer and I read a bit and I go, no, it's okay. And then I move slightly back and it's a bit like when you're having an eye test and you can see okay at one point, it's moved back slightly and it all goes wrong. It's like that.
So it must be so wonderful for you when you got this end result. And you've got quotes from people like Marianne Keyes, who we've just heard from, of course, on this very episode. Marianne Keyes loves the book. I mean, that's an absolute win, Helen. I'd retire right now.
I think I should. I think I should quit while I'm ahead. That was amazing. When her quote came in, it was not just the quote, it was the thought of her reading my book. The thought of her, like, sitting there with my book. Because I've got this kind of fantasy of walking down a street or in an airport lounge, like anyone's ever going to do that again. But I just have somebody, like, reading my book and going over and going, I wrote that book, can I have a selfie with you? But the thought of Marianne Keyes, you know, reading it just, blew my mind a little bit.
So, you know what? All these writers like you who go on these huge journeys, these... you know, faced with their novel living in a drawer and hiding away forever and ever. Once it's out there, you have every right to dance around and basically have a one-woman parade wherever you see your book.
I know. And do you know what? Just I've browsed through bookshops and I pick up a book and I put it down, I pick it up and I put it down. Every time you pick it up and put it down, what you're forgetting is that there is like a human being who's at home probably in complete turmoil, that the fact that someone's picked their book up off the shelf and gone, nah, I don't think so. What's the next? What's
exactly.
next? You know?
Exactly. Nah. Exactly.
Doesn't sound like my sort of cup of tea.
Yeah, no, I think you should always, always have, you know, absolutely no shame in promoting yourself and promoting these books, because it's a huge journey to get to this point. And you know what? Who knows what might lie beyond this book? And let's talk about this idea now, Helen. Has it been optioned? Are there conversations about this being turned into some sort of visual feast?
Well, lots of people who have read it, and I think perhaps you do need to kind of get further into the book, perhaps to be a little more aware of it. It is a book that I think, or a story that works quite well visually. I think that myself, and I don't think that of everything that I've kind of put to paper. And lots of people have said, you know, in fact, one review said, if it doesn't get turned into a film, I will eat my hat. And I thought, ooh, I wonder if she's got a massive fleecy woolly hat, or if it's just a tiny one that's just made of sweets.
Yeah. Also, whenever I see that, I'm like, who wrote that comment? Oh, Mr. S. Spielberg. Excellent news. Well, yeah, but the way you write is very visual. And in fact, that sort of connects with another theme of the book, which is a theme of your life, which is the RNIB. You've got a character here who is blind. And obviously, when you're working at the RNIB, audiobooks, in fact, I've been in myself to record audiobooks there. It's a huge part of what they do and what they offer. And of course, that's where you used to work as well. So has that informed you writing this book in some way?
I think it must have. I mean, Louis is lovely. And even if I've had a review where somebody wasn't, like, maybe the book wasn't their cup of tea, but they can't help loving Louis. And
yes.
Louis is a character that I'm really, really proud of. Now, I was kind of proud of him anyway, but I was interviewed by Red Sail at RNIB. And I felt really proud, because he said it was one of the most authentic blind characters that he'd ever read. And
right.
I was just, you know, really moved by that. And because he's not sentimentally written, and he is quite a character, but he happens to be blind as well, which does impact him and his life, obviously. But it's not kind of, I've tried not to make him too sweet or anything.
Yes.
He's quite sarcastic, and he's very clever, and he's funny, and he's good looking. He plays quite a big role. But I think that the reason perhaps he comes across quite well is because I worked at the RNIB. So I had friends who were blind or partially sighted. And he is based on sort of two or three characters that I worked with, kind of amalgamated. And
right.
Not naming any names before you ask me.
And, okay. off air. Okay.
Exactly. But everything that I wrote about Louis they're quotes, really, or conversations that I had with one or more of these people that I worked with. Although Louis did come to life by himself, and he would say things that, you know, I wasn't expecting sometimes. There's a part in the book where Faye is doing an experiment. Faye has my job that I had at RNIB, and she's doing an experiment with Louis where he has to wear a pair of rubber gloves and sort of feel the bust of Mozart or Bach or something. And that's an experiment that I actually did. And so I think my experience at RNIB definitely informed Louis, because he was just like a friend I was writing about. I didn't have to research it, and so it probably came a bit more naturally. The only thing I really researched for that book was Eddie's character, because I didn't know what it would be like to go from being in finance to being in the clergy. But I do have a girlfriend who did that. So I interviewed her to... when I say interview, I mean we went and drank loads of coffee. Well, she told me stuff.
Helen, it's an absolute pleasure to talk to you. Congratulations on Space Opera. This is it's hopeful, it's touching, it's good. I mean, this is a cliche that's trotted out too often, but it's a good life-affirming read. I really, really am enjoying this book. And congratulations again. Space Opera is out. And that's all we've got time for on the Magic Book Club podcast. Head over to magic.co.uk, as ever, to see the rest of our February picks and join the club. And in the meantime, happy reading. See you next time.